Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, Robert Knott is going to be with us speaking of the arts, as he is every Friday. Right now, I'd like to welcome Bill Hutchison. This is Animal Friday, even though it's not officially the first Friday
of the
month.
It's our fake but real Animal Friday.
It's the real one, because last week we were still doing the fun drive, and we were busy and talking to Mark Rudd and all that kind of thing. But right now, we would like to welcome you, because there are all sorts of issues surrounding animals, and one of them, which is not so nice to talk about, is animal cruelty.
It's been on my mind a lot this week. Followers of the local media, and we've had some television coverage, some things from the newspaper on Kermit, who is this really wonderful German Shepherd mix we have at the shelter. Kermit came into us on... Exactly. See, it rhymes with another famous animal.
Named Kermit.
No, Shmermit the dog.
Oh, right.
So Kermit came into us on March 24th, and he weighed 36.5 pounds. He's a 5-6-year-old German Shepherd mix. He should have weighed like 80 pounds plus.
Oh, heavens.
Most of his hair had fallen out from stress and malnutrition, and he was in really, really rough shape. He was covered in cactus quills, couldn't lay down. And so we offered, and are still offering, a $500 reward to anyone who knows what might have happened, information that might lead to the arrest and prosecution, if indeed this was animal cruelty. But in talking to some of our friends, a quick backstory, the animal shelter is a private nonprofit, and we work with the city and the county municipal agencies, animal control agencies, to shelter the animals we pick up. So we are different than animal control and animal services, but we work very closely with them. And in some conversations with them this week, I learned that they get a lot of calls from people reporting animal cruelty, but are often unable to do anything about it. So the way it works is, if you are worried about, say, your neighbor's dog, you can call and ask for a welfare check, and you can do that anonymously, and animal control can go over, and the welfare check basically consists of being able to make sure that the animal has water at all times, is getting food, and has shelter. Like, that's really the bare minimum that the city and county can enforce on a welfare check. For it to be an animal cruelty issue, however, the person who sees it going on has to actually not be anonymous, has to sign a statement, very much like you would with any other kind of court case. And
right.
I was shocked to find out that when people find out they can't just report anonymously animal cruelty, they will often just not report it. They will hang up the phone, they will not give their name, they will not speak on behalf of the animals. And that led to a lot of thinking, like, what is that about? You know, should there be a way for people to report animal cruelty anonymously and have people investigate and so on and so forth? But we don't do that in the rest of the justice system, and I like that we don't. You can't just anonymously tip off the cops, and they can't just come and kick down your door. I mean, obviously there are anonymous tipsters and whatnot, but there are certain controls to make sure that we aren't living in a fascist state. And it's really been weighing on my mind how often people will stay within their comfort zone rather than advocate for an animal who can't speak for itself. And that's an interesting social happening, I think, in this country, in this town. It's widespread, I think.
I think there's another issue, too, because we have talked with Linda Siegel and with others during the legislative session when they were trying to pass laws relating to animal cruelty on a state level, that people who engage in animal cruelty often engage in human cruelty, domestic violence or other kinds of violence. So I would imagine that if you have a neighbor and you report them and they are engaging in animal cruelty, you might be afraid that they're going to kick your butt.
Absolutely. There have been well over 50 studies since the 50s and 60s, really high-ranking sociological studies linking domestic abuse to animal abuse. And indeed, I would be fearful if I saw my neighbor beating his dog, that if I reported him and the cops or the animal control went and talked to him and said, your neighbor Bill said you're whacking on your dog, that he would come over and smack me around too. And that's a very viable fear. But at the end of the day, what I'm left with personally, and I don't want to put words in anybody else's mouth or tell you how you should behave, but at the end of the day, I just don't know that I'd be able to live with myself, protecting myself or potentially protecting myself at the expense of an animal who I know is is being injured or being really mistreated badly.
And that's it's a really a moral and ethical boundary line that is difficult because, I mean, if you... My father taught me when I was young not to swerve your car for animals. If a dog runs out in front of you, then brake and try not to hit it. But don't swerve, because if you swerve, you could hit another car, injure a human being, hurt yourself, and the dog walks away and you're in the hospital in traction for 6 months, or somebody else gets killed. And a dog's life is not as important as a human life. And on some level, although I'm the number one dog lover who ever lived in the history of the universe, I believe that. A human life is more important than a dog life, so I can see how people would want to protect themselves rather than their neighbor's dog.
Absolutely, and I think that's exactly what's at the heart of folks not being inclined to leave their name or to go on the record for things. And I can understand that mindset. I really can. It makes a lot of sense to me. Something my dad taught me was never get into a pissing match with your neighbors, which has served me well in a lot of ways.
Is that something that happened a lot in your neighborhood?
You know, I grew up in rural New Mexico. This is I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and rural New Mexico was different even then. And I think those who are older than me even recognize that that times have even then things were better than they had been. But again, for me, it comes back to at the end of the day, those of us who are animal lovers, I can understand if someone is not that interested in the plight of animals in our society. But I think for anyone who is engaged in any kind of animal advocacy, even if you are just a person who loves your dog and doesn't think bad things should happen to them, I still think at the end of the day you have a responsibility to speak up for when you see something wrong, even if it puts yourself in some jeopardy. And I think potential harm to yourself compared to known harm to the animal is it's really an equation that has an obvious answer to me.
So are there any mechanisms in place to protect, I mean, it's not whistleblower protection, but it kind of is, protect people who are trying to look out for the welfare of others?
Sure. I mean, there are things, and they're obvious, and I'm going to argue against some of the protestations that I can imagine after I say this, but you can, of course, if you're having problems with your neighbor, take out a restraining order, et cetera, but that doesn't really cover, like, what happens when you're at work and potentially your neighbor comes over and whatever, smashes your windows, burns down your house, steals your car, whatever it is.
Now, also, well, okay, go ahead. We'll get back to some protestations in a moment.
But I think one of the things that we might expect to hear is, well, do these agencies who are charged with protecting these animals, will they really go after these people and make it happen? Or perhaps people have had experiences that they found less than satisfactory with an animal agency not really pursuing something as fully as they thought they would. And ultimately what it comes down, I know that I can sound very strident sometimes when it comes to animal welfare, but I do feel that ultimately we have this responsibility regardless of the external circumstance. We do have to protect ourselves. We do have to take care of ourselves. But really what I see at the shelter every single day are hundreds of animals in the shelter at any given moment who have absolutely no one who will speak up for them. You can speak up for yourself. If someone does something terrible to me, I have some recourse because I have a voice and I have greater protections under the legal system. And certainly, if there are failings in any of the agencies who investigate these issues, then it still doesn't absolve us of the responsibility to do the right thing. And my fervent hope would be that if people could really stand behind their beliefs when it comes to advocating for animals, especially animals in immediate jeopardy, that we would find our city and our county definitely able to rise to the occasion and to support what a community wants, which is being able to take an active role in stopping animal cruelty in this community.
We're talking to Bill Hutchison. What I was going to say before is it's not a given that if you make a sign a statement saying that there's animal cruelty going on next door, that there is going to be retaliation. I'm sure there have been plenty of cases where the wheels of justice have just simply moved without anybody getting hurt.
Absolutely. There are, and I think when we talk about weighing the potential risk to you versus the known risk to the animal, that's really what I'm thinking of. The links between animal abuse and domestic violence are completely obvious and proven to the anybody who thinks about it or sees the studies that have been done. But that doesn't automatically mean that if you report your neighbor for kicking his dog, that you're going to be the next one on his list.
Exactly.
And indeed, a lot of animal cruelty happens by children who are the victims of domestic violence. And that's where it begins. That's where that cycle begins. And I think the responsibility is not just to the animal, because a responsibility to an animal in a community is really a responsibility to a community. And I would hope and pray that anybody who sees a child behaving cruelly or abusively to an animal would indeed intervene in some way, not just for the sake of the animal, but for the sake of that child and getting them out of this cycle, which is really, really dreadful and nightmarish for any of us who have ever been affected by domestic violence. We understand that getting out of that endless cycle is about the most important thing to making a positive change for a community, whether it's the human part or the animal part.
Now, it is worthy of noting that the stronger penalties for animal abuse did not pass in this legislative session.
It did not, but what we have to work with right now are the felony animal cruelty laws that have been on the books for, I think, about 10 years now, and they need more teeth. I mean, that's the other part of it. I think that it's well and good to sit in your house and hope for a better day for the animals, but I don't know that that really necessarily affects much of a change on behalf of animals. So even if you are not seeing a neighbor or someone else abusing an animal and you aren't able to step in and intervene, what you can do is advocate for animals in general by letting the people who represent you know that this is really an important issue. We had the governor at the shelter on Monday to sign a couple of animal welfare laws, and he's a responsive governor to animal welfare issues. It is something that gets a lot of public opinion going, and there's a lot of feedback, and I think that using public opinion to advocate for animals, why on earth would we not do that?
There is also, when we feel animals as citizens of our community, so to speak, they don't have rights to vote, but they do have rights to live and be happy. I think it's a kind of gateway thing to the greater environment.
Absolutely. I'm taking a class on Aldo Leopold right now, and his philosophies of the land community. And one of the things I'm struck by more and more is that when we talk about a land community, we're not just talking about an ecosystem or environmental considerations, but how all living creatures live with one another. And to put cruelty into the world is a terrible thing, and to take cruelty out of the world is a magnificent thing, and not just a magnificent thing, but ultimately, and again, I know I'm sounding like a bit of a broken record here, it is our responsibility to do this. We have an ethical responsibility to stand up for what is right and to speak what should be spoken, what is silent.
It's also very hard, and we've talked about this before too, when you see not even cruelty, but smaller examples of mistreatment. For example, recent example, a man dragging a little dog along the street. The dog needs very badly to do its business, and he won't stop. And the dog is whimpering and crying and trying to stop at every fire hydrant, and the man won't stop. And I was with a friend, and what do we do? And, you know, the guy disappeared, so there was nothing to be done at that moment. But do you say something? And it was clear, and my friend and I had a discussion, and she said, he's cruel. And I said, he's ignorant. He didn't notice. He was busy trying to get somewhere. She says, no, he noticed. How could you not notice? And, you know, do you do an intervention on the street?
That's a great question. And I think there are often two types of cruelty. There's the cruelty that is very much intentional. When you kick your dog, you know you are being cruel to your dog. But there's also the second kind, which I call the you don't know until you know kind. And I think that is an eminently more forgivable kind of cruelty, because it's an inadvertent cruelty. And most people, given the choice, when they really know all the information, will make the right choice. Many won't. And those are the people that I hope we would stand up against. But for a lot of people, myself included, you know, I remember when I was in my teens tying up my dog outside a coffee shop while I went in to read, and I really just didn't think anything of it. She was tied to a parking meter out front. I knew she wasn't going anywhere. But she was miserable, and she wrapped herself around the parking meter. I couldn't see it. She was she's a very tall dog, so her head was bowed low, and she couldn't stand up all the way. And I went outside, and a guy who was standing out there, oh, he just read me the riot act. You know, how could you do this? And I was furious. I got right back in his face. I said, how dare you, blah, blah, blah. But over the years, I've really...
But if he'd approached it a certain, a different way, instead of reading you the riot act, said, dude, you know, your dog's hurting, you should really be careful.
I don't know that I would have responded better, but yeah. I do know that in the intervening years, I have wished that I could see him again to apologize, because even though I acted like a world-class jerk when he said that, in the moment, you know, I was very defended and felt very embarrassed about my behavior. But I think about that moment probably once a week, and it absolutely changed my interaction with my wonderful, wonderful dog and to my dogs in general.
And the moral of that story is, if you intervene and it doesn't go so well, that doesn't mean that it, in the long run, it hasn't gone so well.
It's not, it's not over. The two-minute interaction you have, I think that I'm a good example, and there are thousands of other good examples that... You plant a seed, and I think that is our responsibility. You cannot imagine that you will raise and harvest the whole crop yourself, but you can be part of a group of people to whom this is very important and to whom planting and harvesting a better future for all of us, not just animals, really is part of a life's work.
And a golden tomorrow.
Absolutely. Not to sound too Pollyanna-ish about it, but I wouldn't say it if I didn't believe it.
So here's another... hypothetical example. Let's say that your neighbor's dog is being abused or neglected in some way or another, and the dog gets out. Do you have the right to then take it to the shelter instead of giving it back to them? Do you have the right, like, let's say it doesn't have a collar, but you know whose it is, do you have the right to give it to somebody who will, you know, treat
it
better?
That's a very good question, and it's a question
that
we've run up.
There's both ethical and legal ramifications of that. I know somebody to whom that happened on the other side of town.
I think the way you just said that is perfect. There are ethical and legal ramifications, and I do think that sometimes the legal ramifications and the ethical ramifications can be at odds, but here's what I'd say about that. In the state of New Mexico, an animal is viewed as property. So if I have your animal, and I know it's your animal, and I give it to somebody else. In the eyes of the law, that's very much like having your bicycle and knowing it's your bicycle and still giving it to somebody else. But we have encountered many times over the years situations where exactly that happened, where someone believed a dog was not being, or a cat was not being treated properly. And they lifted the animal or liberated it, or after it liberated itself, they further liberated it by increasing the distance between the animal and its home, by taking it to the shelter or placing it elsewhere.
Well, can you take it to the shelter?
I mean, it seems
that would be legal, certainly ethical.
Well, yes, you can take any animal to the shelter. We're an open admission shelter. But if we know that the animal is owned, we're a nonprofit organization bound by the law, and we, the shelter, won't break the law. And I know that that seems perhaps in contrast to what I've been saying, but the shelter has to protect its ability to care for animals for a long time to come, 6,000 animals a year for the next kajillion years, hopefully less as time goes on. But we won't risk being shut down or jeopardizing our ability to help hundreds of animals by encouraging someone to break the law. But we do take animals over the counter from individuals in the community, our Good Samaritans, who bring us a lot of strays or their own animals as owner surrenders.
I like the idea of over-the-counter animals.
Often they are actually, especially the small ones, passed right over the counter into the waiting welcome arms of our staff. But I do think that it's a hard moment when what you believe to be ethically right comes counter to what you know to be legally right. And
that's a moment,
I think, for each person to decide.
Let's say the dog doesn't have a collar. It finally gets out of its enslavement. It hops into your yard, and you say, good doggy. You take it to the shelter. And then if the people want their dog, they call the shelter, and they look for it. And if they don't look for it, then they're bad dogs.
I say time and time again, lost pets come to the shelter, do you? And we find that a lot of people don't think to come to the shelter looking for their lost pets, but many, many do. And I think if you come to the shelter looking for your lost animal, you're already pretty far ahead of the game in my mind. And I think we are often able to address with people, there are certain things that are obvious, an animal who hasn't had enough to eat, an animal with injuries or bruises or whatnot. And we're able to, in many situations, have a very earnest and honest conversation with the owner and let them know that we are a witness for this animal and that we see what's happening, and we offer some solutions if there are problems. They can let us know, and try and make something constructive out of it. Getting very, having a lot of enmity or making, I don't know, pointing fingers and passing blame is rarely a good way to get people to behave better to animals. It may save that animal in that moment, but we really want to have the long-term plan in mind. And I think that's very important. But it's a quandary. It's really a hell of a quandary. I understand that.
Yeah, yeah. So on a completely different note, how was Puppy Palooza?
Oh, man, Puppy Palooza was unbelievable. So as you know, we had 6,000 mile an hour winds on Saturday when we started our big puppy event. So
we had a monsoon tsunami hurricane.
Oh, it was crazy. We had dust so intense at the shelter, there was zero visibility out the windows. But so instead of having tents and lots of puppies outside, we took all the office hallways and set up lots of little pens and what looked like refugee camps for puppies throughout every hallway in the shelter. And we got 53 puppies out of the shelter. There are weeks where we don't do 53 adoptions in the entire week. And so to get these puppies out of there was, it was awesome. We had so many people there. It was madness. But
if you'd had a deck of cards crazy. Plus a joker, you could have given them all away for each one.
We
for
really
each
could
puppy.
Have, absolutely. It was amazing. When you tell a community that we're going to have a whole bunch of puppies in one place, it is like a cuteness magnet that turns quickly into cuteness overload.
And hey, have you ever seen?
It was great.
Have you ever seen?
Do not say it. Don't say it. All right, you can say it.
Cuteoverload.com.
Yes, you send me these links all the time, and it is a cute overload. It's more than I can handle. We're going to shelter for God's sake.
I don't send it all
sake.
The time. I've stopped looking at it because I was starting to get like pre-diabetes.
Yeah. I was getting pre-diabetes, too. They're very treacly and sickly cute, but they are adorable.
There's a lot of cuteness there.
That's the nice thing about a puppy in real life, is that it's not a picture. So it's very cute, and then it tears up your socks
and
does its business on the floor.
Yeah, and then it eats all your shoes.
Exactly. So you get the true balance of what a puppy cuteness is.
At another time, what we need to talk about is, do you give a puppy its own shoe so that it only eats that shoe and no other shoes? Or do you never give it any shoe at all so that it learns that it can't eat shoes?
My personal belief on this, and we don't have to talk about it later because I can give you the sum up right now,
okay.
Which is if you give a dog a shoe and say, this is your shoe, your dog is going to say, shoe, me like all shoes. A dog is not going to differentiate between your expensive Bruno Mollies and the leftover Ked that you gave it to chew on. You will be training your dog to eat all shoes.
And that is why if you have enough shoes in your closet, more than enough, you should give them all to your doggies to get rid of.
That's right.
Then you can like get rid of all clothes the same way. And
what I've done is give all my shoes to my dogs, and now I just strap strips of tire from my car to the bottom of my feet.
Yeah, that looks so nice. People should come into the Santa Fe Baking Company and see.
Yes,
Bill
speaking
Hutchison's
of puppy
feet.
Refugee camp.
Because that's what I thought too. And then I had an old singular shoe. And I gave it to Milk when he was a puppy, and that was the only shoe he ever chewed on.
Milk proved me wrong.
Well, Milk is an anomalous dog.
I think so, too. I think, on the whole, giving your dog this is the okay shoe is probably not going to work.
Bill Hutchison is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. He's with us here the first and sometimes second Friday of every month, talking about dogs and cats and animal welfare and all sorts of things. And we look forward to seeing you in a month.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. If folks want to keep up with Kermit's progress, he came in at 36.5 pounds. I weighed him on Wednesday. He was up to 38.2. I've got a little section on the website that you can check him out at. It's www.sfhumanesociety.org. Look for the Kermit updates, and you can see a picture of this fabulous guy as well as all other adoptable animals.
And I would like to send a special shout-out to Claudia, who
the
wife of the Toyota man, and she's down at the Toyota man, which is a Toyota repair shop. And she does amazing things for the shelter and for Kermit. She raised money for Kermit's vet bills.
Hundreds of dollars for Kermit, and the donations for him have been coming in. It really warms the cockles of my heart when this happens. We've gotten lots of donations to help Kermit, and whatever's left over is going to be there to help the next Kermit.
And she also sells books. So if you have used books, you can bring them down there, and then she sells them for a very low price. You can go in and browse the
That's
sort
right.
of weirdly random selection of books down there.
I take a lot of my own weirdly random books down there.
I do too.
And I have a couple of her peace cranes, which she also sells to support the shelter, hanging from my office
at
the shelter.
Yes, it's all true. So thanks to the wonderful Toyota woman.
She's the best. Thank you, Claudia.
And thank you, Bill Hutchison.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. We'll see you next time.
We're going to take a little break right now. Robert Knott is on deck.